This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. In the studio with me today, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon for his monthly show. How are you today, Dr. Rajesh?
Very well, Xiaoyik. Thank you.
So today we're talking about music and movement. It occurred to me that, when we watch a musical performance, when we watch a musician playing or a dancer performing, we're focusing on the art that's coming through. But there's a lot of intricate movements that are going into producing what we see as just a thing of beauty, really. So we're going to look at, the perspective of that from functional movement today. And if you have any questions for Dr. Rajesh, or if you'd like to weigh in on anything, you can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 01878-9899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And I think when it comes to musculoskeletal issues, we often talk about the impact of sports on athletes' bodies. Is it too far out there that we're talking about musicians today?
I think your opening line was absolutely beautiful when you said movement and music. Because if you sort of put yourself in, if you're at the Malaysian Philharmonic, for example, mm-hmm. right? And you're there in the seat, it's all dark, you're listening to music, and the music moves you.
Mm.
So the idea that music is made through muscles is only part of the story. Music is made in the heart and mind and expressed through muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the problem with treating musicians or other people like dance performers, ballet dancers, people who use their body as a vehicle for expression.
Mm-hmm.
Lose the normal senses of feedback that say, this isn't quite right. So that sort of normal things that the body will tell you, look, you're in an uncomfortable position, move away from this position, those things get suppressed because you're sort of so engaged in that particular encounter.
Mm.
So I think that's probably an aspect which is really very different when you talk about music and movement, or sort of if you put sort of art and movement together, as opposed to just sort of sports and movement, right?
Yep.
Because sports is, I would say, unless you're playing at a very, very high level, you don't get sort of as involved as it were. Whereas even the simplest expression of music done correctly does involve quite a high level of, sort of brain involvement in directing the skeletal system.
Mm, and it's got to be so precise, isn't it?
I think the precision comes with practice. And I think the practice is where the problem is. The problem's not in creating the movement. The problem's in the adaptations in the skeletal system, which the musician has to undertake in order to create the movement. So a lot of the time, what you're looking at is sort of very, very high skilled activities is muscle memory and muscle learning,
mm-hmm.
right? So that means that you've just done things that many times that you don't have to think about how it's done. So, a sort of very simple example is somebody throws a ball at you, you catch the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if you practice lots at it, you're better at catching balls. If you have no practice at all, you're not so good. Some people inherently a little bit better, some people inherently a little bit worse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a skill that you can practice and develop. And you can catch a ball more quickly than we should be able to. Okay, so if you just take computing power and you say, well, if I have a camera that looks at a ball coming towards the camera at a certain speed,
mm-hmm.
right, how fast would I need to be able to go through the computations and move a mechanical arm to be able to catch the ball,
mm-hmm.
right? Now, the human body can do it faster than that,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's because we've got this muscle memory, we've got sort of a real sense of space, of time and things around us. But it's a training that really affects musicians, and people who want a career in music start training from very early on.
Yes.
Okay, so we know that the skeletal system is plastic, we know that it adapts, and we know that those adaptations encompass bone, tendon, ligament, muscle, even nerve. So
mm-hmm.
one of my most fascinating cases was a musician who had a cut to his finger from a snapped steel guitar string.
Right.
Right. So that's like being cut by a sharp razor blade.
Mm.
and it was his dominant hand that was his, no, it was his non-dominant hand, his left hand. So he picks with his right hand on the strings and he holds the frets with his left hand.
Okay.
So the cut was on his left index finger.
Mm.
And the amazing thing that I found during the operation is the size of the nerve was enormous, right? So, you know, we do lots of operations. So we can sort of ballpark, well, this is how big a nerve should be in the average person, given the gender, height, weight, and other predispositions. But this guy's been playing a guitar since, you know, he was a pre-teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's continued playing. And the thing that really sort of surprised me was how thick the nerve to that finger was. And it was interesting because after I repaired the nerve, obviously the sensibility to the nerve wasn't 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's just, there's no way that you can get 90%, maybe 99%, but you can't get 100%. And he could feel that loss of tonality in his finger.
Wow.
Right? So he could say, the notes I play with this finger don't sound quite right to me.
Wow.
They sound right to everybody else, mm-hmm. right? But they don't sound quite right to him. And that's the sort of micro movement that you can imagine, you know, when he's holding a string down, the sensory feedback that he gets from his fingertip helps him to maintain a certain pressure.
Mm.
That pressure on the music string changes the tonality of the string when you create the sound.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you talk about sort of orthopedics and musicians, you tend to get this very pedestrian view of, you know, shoulder pains and elbow pains and, you know, sort of repetitive use injuries. But the spectrum's really a lot more interesting than that. It is how the skeletal system affects the ability to produce the art that they need to produce.
Mm. And I mean, well, I'll throw out my repetitive stress injury questions out.
No, we can have them. Look, repetitive stress injury is basically just that. You know, you've got this sort of wear tear repair cycle, and there's just too much wear and tear. There's not enough repair. And just this afternoon, I saw a lady in clinic. She was exactly 50, and she had this problem where she had pain on the thumb side of the wrist. Right now, I examined her, the tissue was thickened, I did a scan. The tendons were 3 times as thick on that side than the other side. And, you know, I treated her about a year ago for some inflammation. So the question was, well, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
So firstly, the tendons, we take the wear tear repair model. Now, the tendons are thickened because they're in disrepair. So instead of the tendon being a sort of good balance of interstitial substance and cells, it's really an accumulation of degenerate interstitial substance.
Mm.
That doesn't make much sense. Okay, let's go one step back.
Okay.
Let's go to connective tissue 101. So the skeletal system is made up of connective tissue. And when I teach my medical students, we talk about different classes of tissue. And this class of tissue is called a connective tissue. The characteristic of a connective tissue is two. Firstly, the fact that there are cells. And secondly, the cells are embedded within a stroma or within sort of a matrix. So if you take, for example, when somebody's pouring concrete, they put metal bars within the concrete, right?
Mm-hmm.
So those metal bars reinforce the concrete.
Mm.
So the metal bars are like the cells and the concrete's the interstitial substance.
Okay.
So if you vary the composition of the concrete, you know, you put bigger stones, smaller stones, you put very fine sand, you can put air bubbles in it, you know, the steel, you can have sort of different shapes of steel, mesh, ridges, things like that. You get sort of a different composition. So the skeletal system, basically, a healthy skeletal system has a number of cells, and those cells produce this thing called the interstitial substance. That means the stuff that sort of glues the cells together.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in order to maintain a healthy balance, the interstitial substance, which is mechanically active, degenerates, and then the cell removes it and replaces it with healthy interstitial substance.
Okay.
So it's a sort of constant process of replacing your tensile tissues, as it were. What happens in degenerative conditions is the ability of the cells to remove the degenerate stuff decreases.
Mm.
And the ability of the cells to produce the new stuff also decreases. And in some instances, the cell numbers also decrease.
Mm.
So a lot of the time on imaging, you know, be it on MRI or ultrasound, you'll get this sort of tendon that's thickened. And a lot of the time I read the report that says swelling of the tendon. And, you know, that's not really correct because the tendon's not swollen. The tendon's thickened.
Mm.
Because swelling in the common sense suggests that there's water in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, a little bit of increase of water, but really from a cellular level, what you're looking at is thickened tendon.
Mm.
So if you go back to how that affects sort of... So for this lady, for example, the reason is very simple. She was doing exercises 3 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And those exercises all required really repetitive use of her right hand. And then for the rest of the day, she spent her time at a computer with, again, using the right hand extensively.
Mm.
We reduced her load a little bit by giving her a trackball mouse as opposed to a regular mouse. And she said, I go back to the regular mouse and the problem just comes back. So for musicians, it's the same thing. It's a wear, tear, repair.
Mm.
And, you know, when you have to practice 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day, that's not a lot of time for repair, right? That's really a lot of wear and tear. Mm. So that's where the overuse conditions come in. So the overuse conditions come in by the fact that you've got tissues which go through the wear, tear, repair, don't repair correctly.
Okay.
So those sorts of problems are usually a deep set ache. People say, you know, it doesn't really hurt in the sharp, somebody's pricked me or pinched me kind of way. But it's just this really deep set ache that's uncomfortable, right? I've got to sort of squeeze the part, massage the part, move the part, then it feels better.
Mm.
So that's sort of tendon substance pain. Then the next one is, of course, inflammation. So when you get sort of thickened tendons rubbing up against each other, rubbing up against other structures, rubbing up against nerves, those structures get entrapped.
Mm.
So you get these sort of secondary problems. But the whole idea with overuse type syndromes, I think, is not just to call the syndrome. You know, you don't call it a carpal tunnel syndrome or de Quervain's disease or intersection syndrome. It's really helpful to be able to say, well, what is the tissue involved? So which structure is involved? What is the process that's affecting that structure? And what in my patient's biomechanic is involved in that structure?
Mm.
Okay, so that's really sort of a practical way of looking at the problem, which makes sure that the patient has a help yourself kind of model about what needs to be done.
Mm.
There's a very famous story about a violinist who had a flexor tendonitis. So that means that the tendons on the palm surface of the hand were inflamed. Somebody blindly gave a steroid injection, tendon ruptured, boom, bye-bye career.
Oh, that's horrible.
It is, isn't it? But in a normal...
That's what you're always talking about as well. Just literally just treating that particular issue without looking at the bigger picture.
Correct. And guess where we are? Sorry, that was a barn door. I had to take a shot at that.
No, I opened it for you.
Okay.
With overuse conditions, is that the kind of a complaint that would be present? They feel it when they're holding the instrument or when they're in that position, and then it goes away after? Is that how it presents?
No, it's usually after. So I have two girls at home. I have two daughters at home now. One of them plays the violin, and she picked up the violin because she needed to do an instrument. And she said, I want to do this. Now, you know, for a 12-year-old, she's pretty hardworking, right? So, you know, being the sort of lazy parent that I am, I said, yeah, sure, you know, go find the teacher, get the violin, do what you want. And when you can prove to me that you've actually not just, you know, going to put it down in a month or so, then I'll take a little bit of interest. And, you know, sort of 6 months down the line, she's actually very, very good because she's interested. Now, what happens with her is when I don't know anything about playing a violin, but I know when something doesn't sound quite right and I can correct biomechanics. So when I watch her play and she sort of produces a screech, it's because the string is on the bow and her elbow is drifting forward and backward on the string. So that produces a screech. So that sort of thing I can correct. So what happens with her is because she's really interested, she'll get into the position, she'll play. Then once she finishes playing, she'll sort of flick her neck one way and make a big crack and then flick her neck the other way and then make another big crack and go, oh, that was uncomfortable.
Mm.
And that's usually how musicians come to me, right? They can execute the movement because they're just so involved in it, but the pain comes after.
Mm.
Sometimes they'll come to me when they can't practice. Okay, so they say, well, or when they've lost control. So nerve entrapment syndromes, a lot of nerve entrapments around the elbow, the ulnar nerve in particular, that gives you fine motor control of the hand and power in the last two fingers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they'll come and say that my fingering is not good anymore. You know, I can't do it. Or I start off okay, but then I fatigue really quickly, right? So those are sort of indicators for me to look at, well, is this a nerve entrapment syndrome? Where is it coming from?
Mm-hmm.
How is it related to the posture while you play?
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of biomechanical factors can we correct?
Okay. Posture, I want to come back to that after the break. In the studio with me, consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh, we're talking about music and movement, really the issues that musicians and, you know, we'll go into perhaps dancers a little bit as well, the kind of skeletal issues that they would be facing. If you have any questions, call us 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me today, consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh. We're talking about music and movement. If you have any questions and or thoughts you'd like to share about this, any of your experience you'd like to share, maybe you can call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. You know, when it comes to playing a musical instrument and you already walked us through this earlier. You know, it's about sort of getting into that posture. You hold the instrument the way that perhaps you are most used to, and then you sort of just hold on to that until you've finished. And I grew up learning to play the piano, and it so much of your technique was focused on having your hands and your fingers in a certain position, because otherwise you'd be playing sloppily. Which one should come first, though? The posture for technique or the posture for sort of comfort?
Oh, difficult question.
Are they mutually exclusive?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. It's almost like the chicken and egg story. Which one came first? I think that basic technique should be introduced at the start. And that basic technique includes how you sit, the position of your elbows, position of your shoulders, position of your neck, and getting the sort of environment right. And, you know, I don't think that there needs to be an excuse for us to explain to children why it needs to be that way, it needs to be that way, it needs to be that way, you just do it. As they get more proficient and they've mastered the basic correct technique, then they can improvise on it. And I think that's probably true for almost any skilled kind of activity. You know, there's a saying, before you give something up, you must first be able to master it, right? And I think it goes the same with posture. Once you know what the correct postures are, you know what the correct postures to adopt are, and you can learn and maintain those postures, then you can work around them for comfort. You can say, well, you know, this feels a little bit better now, that feels a little bit better then. So you can sort of play and work around it. But you really need to have a central correct methodology first. Then once you've got that correct methodology, you can work yourself around that.
Because, I mean, everyone's different, isn't it? Everyone's different in the way they hold that particular instrument, the way they hold their elbows and push back their shoulders and such.
Every body is different. I think my students at Monash get sick of hearing this whenever I'm teaching anatomy classes, because really every body is different. I mean, just look out that window at people seated at the table there. What if you got 12 people, every single body is different. Now, every person's going to hold their instrument in a slightly different way, the way that works for them, which is sort of biomechanically reasonable and correct. There are some postures which are habitual. So when we train, when we teach surgical trainees, for example, so surgical training 101, when you're standing by the patient's, body and you're operating, elbows have to be by your body, not flapped up in the air like a bird's wing, because that's an excellent way to get tired. Right, so even in surgery, we are probably more guilty of poor posture in surgery than musicians are in music. And part of it is because we have to adapt our body to the body that's in front of us, right? And that particular body may not be able to adopt the sort of comfort postures for us. So skeletal issues among surgeons, hoo-wee, right through the roof.
Right.
But, you know, it's one of those occupational hazards. With musicians, I think there's probably a fair amount that's from lugging of instruments, because you know, I think of, you know, when the MPO dismisses and, you know, I'm there at the lobby waiting for my Grab to pick me up, I've got these, you know, some musicians with instruments that are bigger than themselves.
That's right, yes.
having to lug them around, I'm looking at it going, you know, I can't be comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it's one of those things where, say, for example, I saw a bassist, little girl, or little, not little as in young, but as in a petite person, and she, her case had wheels.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so she could sort of wheel it up to a point where she needed to hoik it.
Mm.
And I thought that that was pretty clever.
Mm.
So those sorts of practical adaptations, you know, if your instrument's bigger than you, heavier than you, then obviously you have to have a logical way of cutting it around.
Mm. I mean, what kind of adaptations would work for musicians? And, you know, you'd have to assess their biomechanics first.
And, you know, I think that's going to be my theme for the rest of the year, the sort of the biomechanics, because the sort of the wear tear repair model's very good, but it's a little bit difficult to engage with the patient to say, well, you know, you've got this tendinopathy, a tendon stick, and it's three times the other side. There's some intrasubstance degeneration, and there's some adhesion to the next door tendon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit easier for them to. It's a little bit easier for me to say to them, you know, when your hands on the keyboard, then do like this one. Because it's the summary, right? And so
it's related to their function.
It's related to their function. Part of the challenge is, you know, you sort of, you look at, let's just talk about musical instruments. You play musical instruments, I'd say 99% with your hand. You know, you do use your feet, you use your feet for the pedal, you use your feet. What other instrument do you play with your feet?
I mean, the piano has the pedals, yeah. The drums have the pedals.
Yeah.
It's
mainly it, isn't it?
I think so.
Anybody can think of
I'm not a musician, but yes, if anybody can think of it, let us know.
Foot-friendly musical instrument, let us know. But
I
anyhow.
I presume you'd mostly be seeing hands, upper body issues.
I see sort of probably waist up, mostly in musicians, dancers, mainly waist down.
Mm.
And I think just one of the fascinating things is the length of the humerus, which is the upper arm bone, in relation to the forearm bone, which is the radius and ulna. Now, in certain racial populations, that ratio is specific. So the Koreans, for example, tend to have quite short humeri in relation to the whole length of the forearm.
Mm.
Yeah, it's just, you know, so you imagine a Korean musician trying to learn a violin or a piano, for example. It's a little bit of a different experience to somebody of a different race who has a different proportion.
Okay.
So, you know, as we keep going back to everybody's different, so the person with different biomechanics would have to make certain adaptations.
Mm.
And this is where I go back even to the yoga class, right? It completely drives me bananas when, you know, I teach anatomy in yoga groups sometimes. And, you know, if I come early, I see the class going on. And I see people sort of contorted and pushed into postures with no real understanding of what is the principle of this posture. And I see the same, I saw the same with my daughter's first piano teacher, so elder one does piano. There was a ruler and there were raps on the knuckles if the posture wasn't in the textbook.
Yes.
Did you have that experience?
Yes.
You did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's just completely wrong because it has no respect for the person, and I don't mean this sort of in a figurative sense, I mean in a literal sense, in the sort of person's biomechanic. So they have to be, you have to understand the biomechanic to say, well, what am I trying to achieve?
Mm.
And if this person makes this compensation or that compensation, is that acceptable in that position or not?
Yep.
One of the teachers of yoga that I'm following up, he has a relatively bad scoliosis. His spine's pretty crooked, but he still can teach at an exceptionally high level. And it's because he's reconciled some of the poses and said, well, for these particular poses, I need to adapt it using movement from my hip. I need to adapt it using movement from this joint or that joint because I can't achieve it with the other joint.
Mm.
But it's that sort of philosophical understanding that really would be ideal for people who teach music to be able to understand the biomechanic and say, well, these are the adaptations that need to be made for this particular body type.
What about adaptations to the instruments? I'm wondering. You know, the instruments are designed according to some sort of a standard model.
Yeah.
People with different, you know, anatomies, like you said, racially, they have different anatomies.
Yeah.
And would they then have to compensate to a point where it's causing more problems?
Yeah, so my younger daughter's piano is a piano violin. So my younger daughter's violin is a 3/4 size violin, but it's a little bit too big for her. just a teeny weeny little bit too big. So for that's pretty easy. Daddy, don't want to spend more money. He says, Sayang, you'll grow into it. Which is true. She'll grow into it.
Okay, fair enough.
So, but for adults who are playing, who have sort of a disproportionate size, they may have to go to specialist instrument makers to get sort of an odd, we call it an odd size, an odd size instrument made for them to be able to play. I mean, if it's your charimaka and it's a professional thing, then obviously it's worth investing, right? If you find that you can't get an instrument that fits you, find a different instrument.
I mean, when I see, especially violinists, it occurs to me, I think, because of the position of the violin on the shoulder and, you know, you having to pinch your neck to hold it, it brings to mind the word torturous. And is there a point at which, you know, the body just shouldn't be pushed to such limits?
Okay, look, let's sort of draw the line between the professionals and the amateurs. So for the amateurs, it is torturous, I agree. But if you watch a philharmonic performance and you look at the violinist, the between their pieces, they're at rest. You know, it's absolutely lovely to watch them. It's like the picture that came to mind for me was bamboo, right? So there's sort of there's bamboo in the wind, and the bamboo sort of reasonably flexible, and the bamboo can be absolutely thrown about by the wind, but still goes back to its state. Right. And so it's that sort of suppleness of movement that the professionals have. Whereas the amateurs are like, you know, a stick in the mud. They don't have that suppleness. And so if you talk about, does music abuse the skeletal system to the point of breaking? I don't think so. I don't think that if you get the philosophy right, if you get the biomechanics right, answer is really no. I've seen musicians with disabilities, right? It's sort of lovely to see how they overcome the deficit that they have in order to make a success of that instrument that they play. And that's actually really quite heartening. Music's not very heavy on the skeletal system. You know, if the joint reaction forces, very minimal, the loads, very minimal. It's some of the repetitive stuff that's really sometimes a bit problematic. The problem is much more with dancers. Right? Now, dancers are a complete different ballgame altogether in terms of the loads that they put onto the skeletal system.
And we'll get into that when we come back from the next break. Then we'll look at the issues in dancers. We are talking about music, well, dance and movement today with Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. If you have any thoughts or questions, you can call us 03-7733-2900. WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh. We've been talking about musicians and the skeletal issues that they face due to things like their biomechanics, posture, the way that they hold instruments, the prolonged periods of practicing and rehearsal, and just basically keeping the body in certain positions. We'll be going into dancers now. And you said that the stress would be far greater on dancers.
Yes, so dancers have this thing called a joint reaction force. So if you take a rubber ball, and you sort of throw it on the ground, it bounces really high. If you just drop it on the ground and don't hit it much force, it doesn't bounce so much. That's called a joint reaction force. So you can imagine the energy in the ball sort of bouncing back very, very high. The challenge with dancers is that their joint reaction forces are enormous because they're sort of ballet in particular, they're using a spring-loaded action to move from one posture to another posture. And in that, they're discharging a large amount of energy in a relatively short time. And I was teaching a little bit of science to one of the younger members of the family, and I said to them, what happens when you discharge energy? They said, well, you get heat. So I said, what happens when you discharge a lot of energy in a short period of time? They go, kaboom! And that's basically what happens. So you discharge a lot of energy in a short period of time, you get kaboom. So you get micro damage to structures. So if you get the sort of wear tear repair model, if you have repetitive low level sort of movements, you don't get the kaboom. You don't get tissue damage. So once you start getting tissue damage, then you have this extracellular matrix where you've got microfibrillar disruption. And that's where the challenge really comes, because once you start getting structural injury, if that injury doesn't repair, then there has to be a compensation. And that compensation will occur at a tissue which may or may not be adapted at that function. And then that tissue has an abnormality. Mm-hmm. And then that sort of cascade goes further down the track.
I mean, if the kaboom is happening, I mean, with especially professional dancers, I think the kind of rigors that they are put through, the kaboom must be happening all the time.
Yes, and that's why they have relatively short-lived joints, right? I see the sort of the abuse belly dancers, firstly, belly is not normal biomechanics, right? You know, sort of if you're a horse, it's normal biomechanics, but we is human, not horse. So the on point in ballet in particular is something that is purely a soft tissue function, right? So it's like trying to balance one ball on top of another, right? It's not that the balls are fundamentally incongruent, but if you're clever in how you can move the ball around, then you can keep one ball on top of another. The challenge with a lot of the approach to ballet is that it's a strength thing. So, right, so if you want to balance one ball on top of another, you have really big arms and then you can balance one ball on top of another. That's not how it works. You need really quick reflexes and you need really good proprioception. So my opinion is this is sort of, for fear of lynching, strictly my opinion. The non-professional ballet schools that put kids through on point as a matter of principle to be able to demonstrate that they can do ballet, I think that's harmful, right? Because you've got this sort of group of young dancers who are fundamentally biomechanically unprepared for the load that you're going to put on them. So if you are fundamentally unprepared for the load you're going to put, you're going to damage the joint. Now, that joint damage then accumulates, and then, you know, by the time they're 30, they come to see me and the joint's frankly arthritic. And then I go, okay, I wonder what we do in this situation here.
And this is in people who weren't even training to be professionals.
These are in people who are dancing, not necessarily professionally, even sort of semi-professionally for fun. It's okay, but get the biomechanics right. I think that's the sort of the message is get the biomechanics right, because if you get the biomechanics right, then you can do it correctly. I'm just thinking, who was the girl that I saw? She was a retired national gymnast. So she's a retired national gymnast and she has her own school. And what happened with her is she has hypermobile joints, as a lot of dancers do, either congenitally or as a result of training. And she had a ligament sprain, which otherwise really wouldn't bother somebody so much. But in her, it destabilized the joint, right? And she showed that she couldn't make certain movements because the joint was frankly unstable. So in that situation, understanding the biomechanics was important to say, well, although this ligament in somebody else isn't so important, given the fact that you have hypomobile joints and the movement that you need to make, this ligament's critically important. So that person ended up having surgery for the ligament to repair it so that she could go back to what she did. I wasn't able to correct her technique. And that's something that sort of we both accepted. We said, she said, look, I've been doing this since I was like, you know, 7 or 8. And I'm 35 now. I'm not going to change my technique. So I said, okay, well, if you're not going to change your technique, at least be aware that this particular routine is something that you need to do less of. And, you know, come back in, you know, 5 years, 7 years, whatever, and we'll have to repair your ligament again.
Right, okay. So hypermobility, flexibility, and very, very strong large muscle groups, that's something that you typically see, I think, especially in ballet dancers.
I think not necessarily large, but strong.
Strong.
And this is one of the wonderful things about the skeletal system. So if you had a piece of wood and that piece of wood was balsa wood versus if you had iron wood, right? It's the same size of wood, same cross-sectional area, but completely different material. And the wonderful thing about the skeletal system is it just does exactly that. You can make balsa wood into nyato. And if you're slovenly, the nyato becomes balsa wood back again.
Okay. But would that be to the detriment of the other parts of the skeletal system?
No. That's one of the wonderful things about the skeletal system. It's completely plastic. And if you don't push it beyond the repair part, it's completely reversible.
But as we said, you know, a lot of, especially the professional dancers, would have very short-lived, you know, joint health. What can we do preventatively?
Ooh, tough one. Don't know. I haven't been sort of in the dance circles long enough. But given the fact things have improved significantly from ye old days where there wasn't proper biomechanical analysis. I mean, now we've got sort of full biomechanical labs within the professional dance schools, right? And those labs look at, you know, what's your hip angle of rotation, what's your table torsion, when you're in a particular position, what happens? Mm. There's a lot of analysis that can go on in order to be able to prolong the careers of dancers and to be able to prevent injury.
Mm.
As opposed to in the old days where people just sort of came off the street and started and, you know, fell out or dropped out when they couldn't keep up.
Mm.
Some things are fundamentally not good for joints, like tap dance is one, right? So tap dance is one which is the exact wrong thing you would do in order to maintain the sort of longevity and functionality of a joint.
You want to talk a little bit about what's happening with tap dancing?
Kaboom, kaboom, kaboom. Really.
It's the impact, impact, impact.
It's the impact, impact, impact. And it's the quick succession of impacts, right? So the way tap dance makes music is basically you're sort of tapping parts of your feet on the ground and you are using it with the weight of the body. Okay. So it's that weight of the body sort of tapping that gives a little kaboom. Now, I mean, good tap dance is obviously very, very rhythmic and very melodious. But that succession of taps, for example, creates tissue damage. And that tissue damage needs time to repair. But if you want to be good at tap, you have to practice into that cannot repair kind of stage.
Right. So are we at odds here then? You know, is there never going to be...
Yeah, for tap, I think so. For tap, I think it's a fundamentally skeletally deleterious activity.
Right.
Try saying that quickly.
Yes, skeletally deleterious.
Fundamentally skeletally deleterious.
What about ballet?
Okay.
And I mean, we're not here to, ruin people's careers.
No, hips okay, knees okay, ankles... Probably correctly, with the correct strength and conditioning before loading, then yes.
Okay.
Right. And
what does that mean, strength and conditioning?
Okay. So when you're going to make an explosive movement, it's the landing. So you have to sort of deconstruct a movement. People think that the sort of the movement's about the movement. The movement's about the deceleration. Not about the acceleration, right? So that's why I drive a very boring car whose sort of moniker goes, you know, we can go from, you know, 100 to 0 in how many seconds? and not the other way
not
around.
Not the other way around.
Right. So it's the same thing with correct technique for any explosive activity is how is your landing?
Mm-hmm.
And then when you work out that you can land safely, then you create the movement. But if you look at all the dance schools, what do? They've got these trampolines. And they've got them bouncing off the trampolines into a foam pit. So what happens is when you bounce off a trampoline into a foam pit, what you're doing is you're working on the acceleration and not the deceleration. Whereas the part that injures you is the deceleration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like saying the fall doesn't kill you, the landing does.
The landing does.
Right? Mm. It's exactly the same.
Mm.
So with all sorts of sports or activities that require ballistic activity, it's really the landing that's important. So for boxers, so I have two boxers on follow-up. Both of them, the problem is the follow-through. So when they punch, their follow-through isn't correct. And that predisposes them to injury. And one of them's a mixed martial arts guy. Huge guy, really powerful muscles. But he's just lost control of his sort of deceleration in the follow-through of the punch.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, because he's so powerful, he keeps injuring his tissues because he overreaches on his punch.
Mm.
So in him, his gym coach just kept training him to be stronger and stronger and stronger,
right?
Which was focusing on the acceleration, but not on the deceleration.
Mm.
So what I did was I looked at him biomechanically and I scanned him and I said, well, you know, if we make your brakes bigger, your engine's big enough.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that was really his solution.
All right. What about long-term issues for dancers?
Okay, look, I think that I don't know of any professional ballet dancer who doesn't have a degree of degenerative joint disease in the feet. I just, not sort of that deep into the dance community, but in all the years and all the variety of people that I've seen, they all have degenerative foot disease. And I'm thinking more about sort of the retired teachers or the retired dancers who now teach, right? They've got feet which look like they've been through the wars. Well, they kind of have. And so for them to be able to demonstrate the movement, sometimes they can't. So I think that's just the cost you have to pay if you want to be at that level of performance.
Okay.
Because you really are pushing the body to its limits in terms of what it can achieve.
All right. So if we come back then, you know, we've gone a little bit post-career. Let's come back to...
In Korea?
In Korea.
Yeah. In Korea, they just don't listen. That's my problem. They come to me and they go, "Doc, it hurts." I go, "Sure, as soon as take the history, do the examination, demonstrate the muscle weakness, demonstrate the tissue abnormality, demonstrate where the pain is coming from. They just want to know, can you take away the pain? I say, yes. Then can I go back to dance tomorrow?" Right. And that's really the current, the challenge that I have with the in-career group, that the performance life of a ballet dancer isn't really very long. Right, the performance life of a pro soccer player is not that long. Performance life of an NBA, you know, basketball
player. Any professional athlete.
Yeah, basically any professional athlete. Their professional life just isn't that long. So, you know, you can't really blame them for wanting to get back to the game and not sort of take two or three seasons off to recover, right? But I think, look, we're adults. As long as you're appraised of what the risk benefits are, then you should be able to make your own decisions.
What about for musicians? Because in that context, we were talking about dancers and sort of that kind of high impact movements. Musicians, perhaps not so much of the kaboom.
Yeah, musicians, not so much of the kaboom, but musicians tend to have really ingrained habits. So, and it's funny because I asked them to close their eyes. I asked them to close their eyes, make a posture. They've made the posture. And then I move them to the correct posture and I take a picture. And then I ask them to close their eyes and make the correct posture again. They've made the wrong posture. Right? So in, and that's a deficit of proprioception. So in their mind, they've made the correct posture.
Right.
But the sort of alignment, as it were, between the mind and the body wasn't quite correct. But for those people, sensory taping for skin is very useful. It's a very useful technique because what you do is you put some tape on the skin and then you sort of at strategic points, so they've got this proprioceptive feedback and then you tell them to close their eyes, correct their posture. Then with the tape on, they can usually correct their posture. But it's not possible to undo, you know, 15, 20 years of learning. It's only possible to have tricks to correct it. So I actually think that we should, the stuff's called kinesio tape. You know, you see it, sort of the very bright colored tapes. You see it a lot on athletes. I actually think that kinesio tapes probably got quite a big role to play in musicians for optimizing their performance. But, you know, I'm sort of thinking of the sort of lovely short sleeve gowns and things
that
like
that. Will look lovely in MPO.
Exactly. The boys have it okay with the jackets, but I think the girls would have it a little bit more difficult with their formal evening wear. But I think that'd be pretty cool. You know, maybe you could have it black, I don't know, something a little bit more formal.
I mean, that's the idea, isn't it? That the discipline must be of the mindset that it can make those changes. And, you know, performance aesthetics aside, what do you need to do to increase the longevity of your career? Do you have a final message?
For this topic, it is magic. It is magic that we can make movement. It's magic that we can make beautiful movement. It's magic that we can make beautiful music with the skeletal system.
See you at the next MPO performance.
I will be there.
That was Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. We were talking about musicians and their movements on the Health and Living Show right here on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.